Welcome to Counterpress on The Ringer and Spotify. I'm with Jesse Parker Humphreys. It's a two-man job today. Our second ever two-man show.
And we're somewhere we're not normally recording.
We're somewhere we're not normally. We are in the Spotify Jam Studio, which is cool, which is within the Spotify building. It's basically a room filled with musical equipment that you can just have a play with. What will you be playing after we record, Jesse?
Well, I'm tempted by both the bongos and the ukulele.
Can you play the ukulele?
I can play the ukulele, yeah.
As in like...
I mean, not like, I'm not talented.
Not like properly. Well,
but
you can play a few tunes.
Yeah. Yeah, I learned how to play Noah and the Whales 5 years' time.
Classic.
When I was in a folk band at secondary school.
I actually used to, when I was a teenager... you just hang out with Noah in the Well.
What?
Yeah.
Sorry, I need more context.
So, back in the day, my cousin and my brothers were really involved in that kind of like indie pop scene. And Laura Marling, Noah in the Well, Mumford and Sons, a little bit cancelled now, but let's not talk about that.
He was at the Oscars last night.
Was he?
Well, yeah, obviously with Carrie.
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant the one that is cancelled, the banjo guy.
Oh, no, the main one.
No, the main one's not so cancelled.
No, he's not cancelled.
They're okay.
I think everyone's agreed he is annoying. Which is sometimes it's worse than being cancelled.
True. Anyway, we used to go to this gig venue underneath the Cornish pasty shop on the King's Road. And there was a band, oh my God, I can't remember their name, that were the precursor to Mumford & Sons. And they used to do gigs under the Cornish pasty shop. Now that venue doesn't exist anymore, closed down like way before COVID. But like Laura Marling used to come by, the Troubadour, West Brompton was also a real hotspot for Laura Marling vibes. And I just used to go watch them play, and my brothers and my cousin were good friends with them. And I don't know where he is anymore, the main guy from, like, what's he up to these days? But Laura Marling's still going. She's still around.
Yeah, I don't know where Noah and the Whale went.
No. And one of my brothers was actually in one of their, like, they did like a feature length music video, and one of my brothers was in it.
That was for the Big Breakup album, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm, yeah. I remember I saw Mumford & Sons very early on. We're at Pure Groove, which is also now defunct.
Oh, see, this is West London pop heritage, indie pop heritage we're talking about. Mystery Jets as well. They were hanging around during that time.
Yeah, love Mystery Jets.
Wow, those were the days. Some of our listeners may remember that.
I feel like we've really aged ourselves.
I know, we have.
By talking about this.
But we actually, at the start of the show, we were actually going to talk about Crufts.
Which
is also aging ourselves. But Crufts was across last week, which for the US listeners is the equivalent of, they do have a dog show in the US, I can't remember what it's called, but whatever that dog show is, Crufts is the UK equivalent. At the NEC Birmingham, a classic vibe, goes on for like a week or so, all the different categories and breeds and awards. And then what everyone really watches is the Sunday Best in Show, finale, Claire Balding, obviously. And it was a bit of a classic, wasn't it?
It was a great lineup of dogs. Everyone was obsessed with the Jack Russell. And I was initially unsure because that's not normally a breed of dog I'm into.
Yeah, or that makes it to the Best in Show, which is why it was such a big
breakthrough. I didn't realise that only recently they were allowed to show them for the first time. But it did have a really kind face. And I loved how Claire kept saying, and it's 9 years old, isn't it? And yeah. I don't know anything about dogs, but apparently that means that's really old to show a dog.
It was almost
it
like
great for its age.
An aged sprinter coming through and getting at 32 to like the Olympic 100 meter final, right?
Yeah, because it hadn't been able to show its peak age because of COVID.
Yeah.
So it was really like, you know, a tournament being cancelled and you missing out.
Yes.
But anyway, that one came second. And then the Aussie Shepherd won. And I thought the Aussie Shepherd was very, very beautiful.
Beautiful dogs.
That's the only one, like, that's what I'm judging on.
Yeah.
I don't
really know the criteria. But I did, what was I texting in the group chat? Really chatting like I know. I can't remember what it was.
Flo Lloyd Hughes talking like she knows something she knows nothing about.
What was it? I'm going to try and find it now. We're live recording. It was so funny. I can't remember. I'm just laughing at myself.
Becky was so fed up about us texting this. She said we were allowed to friend Dulterate to talk about it elsewhere.
She was like, please take your crafts chat out of the group
chat.
Oh my God, what was it? Oh yes, it was when the Jack Russell got awarded second place. And I wrote, that's still kind of big though. I mean, like, I know crafts.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, only came second. And Flo was like, no, that's still really good.
No, because this is the art of commentary. And this is why some people who commentate on big live events that we don't really care about normally are so good, because I think it was Zoe Salmon or someone like that. She'd given me all that insight about how Jack Russell's don't get this far and what we were just saying about how it was such a breakthrough, which made me feel like I was in the know. And I was like, this is still a historic moment, you know?
Yeah, well, congratulations to Zoe Salmon.
Great work. On today's show, we're going to talk about FA Cup weekend. It actually ended up being more dramatic than it looked like it was going to be on the Saturday. Not the most iconic draw, but not everyone can do iconic FA Cup draws. So not everyone is built for that. We're going to talk about that. And we're going to touch on the Gold Cup, USA winning the inaugural edition of the Women's Gold Cup. So let's get into it after this. All right, going to start with what ended up being the only real big upset of the weekend. Oh, maybe we'll count Liverpool losing actually as a bit of an upset, but the real showpiece upset, which was Manchester City losing on penalties to Tottenham. Tottenham getting through to the semi-finals for the first time. I do like how FA Cup in recent years, we had a lot of big semi-final breakthrough moments. Obviously, Manchester United getting to the final last year was big as well. But another huge occasion for a club which has shown some progress over the last couple of seasons after a bit of a dip as well in the middle. But let's start with Manchester City's performance first, because getting knocked out of two cup competitions in the same week is pretty disappointing. So they've gone from three trophies to just one. And Jesse, it was just a really flat, lackluster performance. And Gareth Taylor admitted as much afterwards, just saying, like, we didn't deserve to win today. He made a couple of changes. Kelly didn't start. Coombs didn't start. Fowler coming in. Philippa Angeldale coming in. But yeah, they just were just a bit poor really all round, weren't they?
Yeah, I do think obviously it's worth thinking about the context for both City and Chelsea of having played on the Thursday night. And I think, I believe it's because City were at the Etihad, they couldn't play that game on the Wednesday. But it did feel like kind of ironic that the other Conti Cup semi-final was on the Wednesday and then neither of those teams had FA Cup football this weekend. But that's the way it goes sometimes. And I think you could see in both those games that Chelsea and City looked pretty spent from what was a very, very intense game on the Thursday night. But yeah, I think for City, this felt like kind of the accumulation of a number of different issues they've had this season. Obviously, there were changes made, but I do kind of feel like there's not enough drive in that squad around who is going to make that, like, first team. Like, for Fowler, I think it was her first start for City in, like, 15 games. If you're coming into that game, do you feel genuinely, like, if you put in an amazing performance, that you're going to start ahead of Kelly regularly? I mean, I don't know. It feels unlikely. Obviously, I think it was right to drop Kelly. I don't think she's been great over the sort of the past couple of games, but I still feel like at the end of the day, she's probably going to be first pick. And, you know, City have made second fewest WSL subs all season. Taylor likes to play a starting 11, but obviously that, like, does add up as the season goes on, and players end up with a lot of minutes in their legs. Other players who come in then potentially aren't as ready to contribute, either because they're rusty or because they're not as, I don't know, tuned into their teammates. And I kind of think that came home to roost a bit for City. They did have chances to win. Bunny Shaw missed a big header, and Ash Neville sort of cleared off the line in extra time. But I guess also we saw a second kind of big Kiara Keating mistake that ends up with City losing a game.
Yeah, I would pick up on the competition for places element, because, yeah, I think that's a big factor, because we've talked about how City were very deliberate in how they've kept their squad fairly small compared to some of their rivals this season. Losing Jill Roard obviously has a big impact, but Jess Park sort of come in and done fairly well there. But like you say, the fact is, when you look at how Chelsea have managed to rotate, for better or worse sometimes, all season, and the amount of players that Jonas Eidevall's had at his disposal, and the fact that he's even loaned out some of those players like Kathryn Kuhl, I think you look at City when they need to dig deeper in games, and these two midweek games were very much that. And when they look tired, you think, oh, what have they got left to find? Who can they throw on in those moments? And I do think the way that Eidevall and Hayes manage their squad, I think, it is really important, because you do see players come on and take that opportunity in a way that, I think, you're right, City players aren't quite able to do for whatever reason. It's like that energy and that impact isn't quite there. The Keating thing, spoke about it on Righty's House on Friday. I think that goal that she conceded, Lauren James's shot in the Conti Cup, I think she could have done a lot better. Obviously, it takes a deflection of Greenwood and it sort of bobbles along the pitch, which is really hard as a goalkeeper. But I do think any goalkeeper getting done at their near post, I think you have to have a few question marks about that, just because it's the no-go zone. And what is frustrating, I think, about the error in this game against Spurs is that it's so similar to what happened in that Arsenal game at Meadow Park, where there seems to be a lack of communication, or there's confusion on what Keating does when she wants to run out and intercept or meet a pass. And there's not that understanding with her defenders who is doing what. And that is something that they can definitely work on. She perhaps isn't the fastest out of the box as well. And, you know, that is, or like, every keeper has those kind of weaknesses. Some are super quick. And like Edison, for example, you look at him, he's like one of the best in the game at, you know, running out and intercepting passes. And that's kind of part of how good
he is. Not yesterday, to be fair.
Not yesterday. That he did cover, have egg on his face there yesterday. But, you know, like, not every goal can be good at that. But I think part of Keating, as she gets more experienced and just, you know, ages as well as a goalkeeper, is actually just understanding your body better and what you can do. I think she's a very brave goalkeeper, which is, like, you know, if you look at her attributes, like top trumps, that's, you know, where she really excels, especially for her age. She's going to come out and she wants to claim things, and that's important. But then it's also about understanding where you balance that bravery with reading of the game and understanding of the game situation. I think that's what she lacks. And I think that's something you can get with age and experience, but perhaps that speed is harder to find. And if she's going to be City's number one, she's going to be in big games and big knockout situations where you can't have those scenarios be the reason your team loses a very important game.
Well, this is the thing that's, I think, really hard for Keating, and why it's not like I'm loath to criticise her, but I do think it's relevant to say, like, this is not someone who's played a ton of, like, professional football. No. And it is hard, I think, if you're in that position, to be playing in games where things are really riding on it. It's, you know, especially in goalkeeping, we often see, like, goalkeepers go on numerous loans lower down the table. I mean, also, for example, like, I often feel like Hannah Hampton is, you know, still kind of learning the ropes and gaining experience. And she's looked really good for Chelsea so far this season. But, like, that's someone who had 100 WSL appearances before she came to the club. And I think, you know, that's something that obviously attracted Chelsea to her, that they felt like she was ready to take a step up. Keating's not in that kind of position at all. And to that extent, it does feel like, well, yeah, it's hard to be learning on the job. I mean, I'm sure City would say to you, if we had Gareth Taylor here with us, maybe he says, I still feel like Keating is the best of the three goalkeepers we have, which is fine. But if you were that certain on that, as he seems to have been from the start of the season, was that not a recruitment question for the summer, maybe, to be like, well, do you, what, like, are you really serious about, if this 19-year-old is the best of all your keepers, is it good for her and good for her development if, you know, she's playing in every single game? Because I think also City are now in a position where I don't think they will drop Keating, but she has cost them in important moments. But if you do drop her, then that feels like that's really, like, bad on her
especially at her age, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I do think that's a little bit of an issue for them. But I guess to a certain extent, it just feels like City as a whole, I think generally over the past couple of years, they've scouted really well. But I do think their squad building has been a little bit haphazard, even in this game when we're talking about like who can come on and options. Like they couldn't bring on Poppy Pritchard or they couldn't bring on Laura Blinkhilda Brown because they were cup tied. And it's like, okay, well, you've gone and got all these kids in January to sort of supplement for the loss of Jill Roord, at which point you're in the title race, you're in the FA Cup, you're in the Conti Cup. You should be going for a domestic treble. But like none of these are options that are actually going to help you win a domestic treble, clearly, because, you know, you're now out of the competition. And the Conti Cup thing is one thing. You know, listen, it's hard to consistently get wins at Chelsea. Like, teams don't go on like long winning runs at Chelsea. And it was a close game and City could easily have come back into it with the chances that they created. But the FA Cup, I really think they should have been looking at that and thinking, this is a great like opportunity for us to go, even if we got Chelsea in the semi-final, this is a great opportunity for us to go and win, having already knocked out Arsenal. Like, you've opened up the path for yourself at that point.
Yeah, so true. And also, no disrespect to the Conti Cup, because it's been an important competition for Manchester City in recent years and Arsenal. But the reality is the FA Cup is a far more prestigious,
You're going to get cancelled for this.
No, but far bigger competition to win. When you look at your season, like that is, if City realistically had ended the season with nothing but the FA Cup, it would still be seen as a bit of a success. Obviously, if they end up with the FA Cup and, you know, just losing out on the WSL, they'd be disappointed. But the FA Cup is something very big to show for your season. Now they could potentially end up with nothing. And it's almost like they go back to square one in where is the progress being shown for it? And then you have the awkwardness of all of this occurring not long after Gareth Taylor gets a new contract. So this has happened a bit this season with, and we spoke about it in relation to the Skinner stuff, where managers are getting rewarded with new contracts of consistency. Now, Idavels came in a very tough moment for Arsenal. When Gareth Taylor got that deal, City were, you know, doing well and looking well-placed in three competitions. Now the narrative has switched a little bit, but you're also piling on more pressure on a light squad that are feeling it in this crunch time point in the season. It's going to be a really interesting, hard run-in, I think, now for City from this point. My stocks that I pumped so much investment into, they are sinking. The market is down. They are sinking. I'm past the point of trying to do a Wolf of Wall Street scam here. I'm just going all in. And if they go down, I'm going bankrupt with my City stocks, basically, at this point.
Yeah, I mean, look, things change quickly in football, obviously. And to that extent, I still don't think the Gareth Taylor, I understand why they gave Gareth Taylor an extension. I don't think this week has to change that. But I do think you're right in terms of mentality for City. It's going to be really fascinating about how he galvanizes this team and galvanizes players, because we've talked about how, you know, this is a young team. They have players who have experience of winning titles, but they don't necessarily have loads of them. People like Jill Roord obviously now aren't available, who would be one of those key figures in that sense. But, you know, losing those two games on the bounce and going out of those competitions and kind of losing their winning streak, I think will rock them, you know. That I think they're lucky that they've got Brighton away, who we might come on to, but like are really not looking great defensively at the moment. So that's their game next weekend. And I think that is a good opportunity for them to sort of refine some confidence, even though they did lose to Brighton earlier in the season. But I think we can say that was almost more an anomaly. But, you know, then they've got a big game at the Etihad against United. And obviously that Arsenal game is the other big one right at the end of the season. And their games whereby they almost act as mini cup finals at this point of the season. And it kind of feels like in these knockout games against Chelsea and Spurs, they've not been able to find that extra level that they need to get the job done. And it was interesting, obviously, watching Chelsea play Everton, who were rubbish. And to be honest, could have had something very similar happen to them in terms of their performance, in terms of the chances Everton created. But at the same time, there's just something about Chelsea, which means it doesn't happen to them. So, and it becomes this kind of intangible, I think, just belief of like, they will find a way to get the job done. And I don't think City have that aura to them.
Yeah, 100%. We're going to come on to Chelsea in a minute, but let's give some love to Spurs because this is a massive result for them. They had to do it the hard way. Some poor penalties, to be honest, from Chloe Kelly and Alex Greenwood get City off to a terrible start. But Becky Spencer did do well. Like, I can't say I'm familiar with her penalty shootout game, but you know,
she helped Birmingham win.
I did
FA
see
Cup
Craig Hadley's tweet to reminisce about Birmingham heritage, but
that's
kind of,
the Kate Longhurst FA Cup final goal.
Oh,
game.
Yeah, famously. Is that the one where she nearly pooed herself?
I think it might be. Yeah.
Okay. So real FA Cup heritage. Yeah, and it's massive, and I think it's. I think Becky Spencer, especially in the North London Derby, had a few potentially scary moments, but actually really held her own well when I think Arsenal were deliberately sort of targeting her in terms of where they were sending balls in, like right under her. I think she did well when it could have been a potentially nervy, you know, a risky game for her. And I think the way that Tottenham, through the last like three seasons, have always sort of rotated their goalkeepers, I think it must be really hard to be a goalkeeper in that squad. So I think it was a big moment for her, even though some of those penalties were easable, savable heights. I do think in women's football, we still see goalkeepers not deliver that. So that's why I think, you know, credit to her for doing that. And a massive, massive result for Spurs. And it's nice to see something to show for their growth because we know they got off to a rough start, especially defensively. There was a bit of a patched together defence at times. They had to play players out of position just because of who they had at their disposal. But we know that there's been a very clear game plan, especially offensively. Martha Thomas leading from the front now that Beth England's come back in. Like the athleticism they have leading from the front and being able to press, it doesn't always work. You know, we saw that in the Arsenal game where they were quite poor. But I think in this game, we saw what they wanted in the Arsenal game was a bit more control and trying to create opportunities and be better in that transition when they do pick off things in the midfield, because that midfield is starting to become so strong and such a key part for them that when they can then use those opportunities to get up the field quickly and use the likes of England and Thomas, that's how they create chances. And I think as the defensive solidities come in, that's helped them now build an all-round solid team, really. And when you look at how things went in that City game earlier in the season, and that was a marker in a couple of days of, I think they conceded, yeah, like 14 goals in two games or something. That was a real low point. But I do think in some of those games where they've shaved the deficit so much and then actually gone on to beat City on pens, it does show a massive bit of growth for a side at the start of the season that were looking a little bit wobbly.
Well, I think what's exciting for Spurs is it really feels like there's a big project surrounding Villaham and getting both the Arsenal result in the North London Derby at their stadium and then this result against City, I think are two moments that can really galvanise a team. Obviously, we've seen individual teams have good seasons before, like we had it kind of with Villa last year. But I think what's really exciting for Spurs and maybe makes me feel more positive about them, not that I think they're going to go and challenge for the top three next year or anything, but that I just feel like they feel more of a project than maybe some of those other sides were, is that it feels like they've built a squad rather than a first 11. And I think the best way that I can kind of sum that up is the fact that when they were playing extra time against City, it felt like they were almost in a position to have the fresher legs and they were able to push forward at points and, you know, put City under pressure. They weren't just having to sit with loads of players behind the ball the way you might expect a team to against City in extra time just to play for penalties. And that was because of the players they were able to bring on. They're able to bring on people like England, like Wang Shuang. And I think, you know, looking back at the North London Derby at the Emirates, like I said at the time, it was almost testament to Spurs that I felt disappointed in them just purely because I thought like the bench they had available to them compared to Arsenal because of Arsenal's injuries and international absentees was almost stronger. And I think that's really, really crucial for sides who are trying to push up. It is about investing in 20 players, not about investing in 11, because there are moments in the season where you're going to have players with injury. And I guess what's exciting for Tottenham now is those players are kind of coming back, like Ash Neville's come back into the team. Drew Spence's available again. Obviously, they didn't have England at the start of the season, but they brought in Thomas and she's looked really good. So, yeah, I think for Spurs, like, I mean, for all three of the teams who aren't Chelsea in this, I mean, I assume everyone would just desperately not want Chelsea in the semi-final, obviously. And probably best case scenario is like a Tottenham-Leicester semi-final, realistically. But like, what an amazing opportunity to get to go and play at Wembley. And I think also a reminder that, like, I know Chelsea have won a lot of these FA Cups in recent years, but we do consistently see on a fairly regular basis, like quite a lot of different teams getting to the final. We've obviously had West Ham, Everton in recent years. Chelsea's opponents over the last 3 years have all been top four teams, but they've all been different. And, you know, there's a real possibility that happens again this year.
Yeah, and I also think Manchester United in that FA Cup final last year, that game was there for the taking, especially mm-hmm. early on, and they didn't quite capitalise on it. So it wasn't even like Chelsea kind of ran away with it in that final. And I just think that just shows that like anything can happen. I do also quickly want to just give Tottenham their flowers as well, because I think when you get a new manager in, I think, you know, part of it is about the new manager working out how to approach games and working out how to best play with what he's got. And I do think Spurs have worked out what they're very good at and what they're not so good at and how they approach games based on the opposition and how they're going to play and how much of the ball they're going to get. I think Spurs throughout this season have worked out and got better at defending and trying to play quick counter-attacking football and using the physicality and athleticism they do have. But I also do think when they now realise in games that they're going to have a bit more of the ball, I think they're very good at creating opportunities. I think Celine Bizet, who had a tough first season under two different managers last season, has been one of their most important players. And I think that is, it's, and I think it's nice to see that growth individually as well, because I think for a lot of these players, the last 18 months before Willian came in were not quite a reflection of their ability. I think it was a reflection of the situation and the way that they're being asked to play. And I do think so much of it is about him approaching games and knowing what risks they can take and seeing themselves through them and just trying to create and be clinical with the opportunities they have had. Anyway, let's move on to Liverpool-Leicester. Liverpool losing to Leicester.
Becky Taylor-Gill's noggin was boiled after this game.
Obviously, a massive, massive missed opportunity for Liverpool, because they would have looked at this draw and with the way that they've been playing this season, like knocking on the door of top four. This, we know what Matt Beard's done in this competition before as well. It is massively disappointing when you've been handed a decent draw to throw away this opportunity at home against a side whose manager wasn't even in the dugout, because as was reported by Susie Rack on Friday, Willie Kirk is currently being investigated for an alleged relationship with a player. So he was not at the game. Two of his assistants were taking the team. So on paper, you think, oh my God, Liverpool couldn't have been handed a better opportunity to get to a semi-final. And they were so disappointing at home as well, in front of a good crowd.
Yeah, they really struggled, I think, to kind of bring the level of consistency that maybe we've seen from them in recent weeks. It was kind of disappointing. I think obviously for the first goal, they'll be frustrated by the defending. I felt like the midfield didn't really work out. I couldn't really understand what exactly, like what role Missy Bokerns was supposed to be playing. And there were also just moments that didn't go for them. Like Marie Herbinger has like a great chance to equalize, and I don't exactly know why she chooses the shot she chooses, but it comes off the bar when she's kind of aiming at an open net. And it felt like, to a certain extent, maybe that was the difference. Like Jutta Rantala for Leicester is someone who I think a lot of people have been excited about watching this season. She's a really fun player to watch. And she kind of feels like at the moment, like if you get her in the position she was for that second goal, you expect her to score, and like to have that when you're sort of a mid to lower table team is such an asset, right? And I guess also what's kind of funny is that Leicester didn't even necessarily put out their strongest team. Like you had like Mamiki coming off the bench, for example. So yeah, I think it will be disappointing for Liverpool. I don't know how much maybe the opportunity to finish fourth means to them. I think most people would say like getting to a cup final would mean more, but it's not like they're in the position of a Leicester or a Spurs where realistically you're not going down, you're going to kind of finish mid-table. Maybe you're looking more for that moment, whereas potentially there is an eye on the WSL because, you know, the opportunity to finish above United is feasible and I think would understandably be... would be a big deal, even though you don't get a prize for it. But yeah, I guess a frustrating day for Liverpool and testament to Leicester, because I'm sure it can't have been kind of an easy weekend going into that game. But they just kind of, it's a bit of a cliche, but it just kind of felt like they were ready to like grab that moment a bit more than Liverpool were.
And I think for all the growth and consistency that Liverpool have found this season, I think there's still been games where you come away a little bit frustrated and irritated at actually how poor and how much of a missed opportunity it was. So, for example, I think when they played West Ham away, ended up drawing 1-0, they lose at home to Everton at Anfield. Like, there were a lot of games where on the balance of play and you look at those performances, you're like, that is a game that Liverpool should have won. And for all that growth and big results and big moments for Matt Beard's team, the difference between them and obviously the existing top four or top three, really, because Manchester United are now drifting, is what they need to find, is like tap into just that overarching control and consistency that you can get in games, because it's there. It's so there for them. And hopefully with another good transfer window, that'll be the difference for them next season. The Chelsea game, Jesse, really was not a classic. I think a lot of games suffered as well this weekend with just like crap weather. It was just pissing down with rain all weekend. And I think that definitely took its toll. Like we mentioned in relation to that City game, Chelsea looked tired, another heavily rotated team, which has, yeah, just been the story of Chelsea season. But they've obviously had injuries that they've had to work with. Ramirez doesn't feature in the squad on Sunday, and it's unclear whether she's picked up a proper injury in that City Conti Cup semi-final, or whether it's just precautionary or potentially some pre-Arsenal Stamford Bridge mind games. So Emma Hayes really had to shift everyone about a little bit. It was not a classic performance from Chelsea by any means, and actually a massive missed opportunity for Everton, who had some good chances. But they got through and the quadruple is still on, and that's kind of all that matters. And again, whenever we get to March for Chelsea, we say the same things in the last 3 years, which is it ain't pretty, but more often than not, they're getting it done. They're tapping into that bit that they have that a lot of other teams don't.
Yeah, I think what was particularly tricky for Chelsea in this game is not only did they sort of have to rotate and rest players for this match, it was then once the match began, Natalie Bjorn had to go off relatively early on, kind of within the first 20 minutes. That necessitated a switch around because Jess Carter had been playing at left back. Charles comes on, Carter moves into centre back. Obviously, yeah, no Ramirez, so Fran Kirby was playing up front. That wasn't really working, so that kind of got switched around. Aggie Beave-Jones then played up front for a bit. Then you've got all these subs because Chelsea still hadn't scored. And then obviously there was still this like need to rest players. So, for example, Aaron Cuthbert came off for Micah Hamano later on, which meant that Neve Charles ended up at centre-back, Aggie Beave-Jones at left-back, so Nusken could go back into the midfield. And that was kind of the point where it felt like Everton were generating a lot of chances. And I think that just kind of shows a little bit like how much Hayes is willing to sort of prioritise the rest and recuperation, and probably prioritise the game against Arsenal on Friday, maybe even over, you know, the games against City and Everton in both these cups. just because I think, you know, that was where Chelsea started to really lose control. But Everton were impressive, I think, in all, you know, this was the third time Chelsea played at Everton this season. And I think their high press works really well. It'd have been interesting to see what it looked like with Hannah Hampton in goal rather than Shaqira Musovic, because Musovic gave about five different passes to Everton in the first half. But I do think having added Cathy Kuhl to that midfield, it's given them a lot more control in those kind of areas. And her battle versus Erin Cuthbert's been really fun both times they played against each other. But it did kind of feel like when Chelsea made their sort of subs on 55, 60 minutes, maybe Everton were like faltering a bit because it's a very high intensity way of playing. And I kind of thought Chelsea would go on from there and get the second, but obviously because they didn't, it meant that Everton, when they brought their subs on, were able to really go for it at the end. But yeah, as I say, you know, in some ways it wasn't dissimilar to City's game against Spurs in that, you know, Chelsea and City are both kind of 1-0 up, and then the opposition does have chances, but Everton can't take theirs. Spurs can. Obviously, Chelsea didn't like have a kind of monumental error in the way that City did, but I do think that is, like you're saying, it's just sort of the March version of Chelsea. They play a lot of games and they try not to lose them, I think. And a lot of the time that means they win them.
Rob has asked, does the March Perenaissance. That was it. And I replied saying, all I'm hearing is Nando's Perenaise. Does the March Perenaissance at Chelsea surprise you again? Which obviously is in relation or in reference to Yves Perisset. So yeah, how important has she been to Chelsea these last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I thought she was exceptional against Manchester City. I thought she was good again against Everton as well. You know, I think she's been really important. And this is also like the reality of Chelsea's squad is that, you know, there are players who'll come in and out of the team. I think Aki Beaver-Jones is a great example of this. Players who don't necessarily get minutes in the first half of the season, but there's always this sense of like, it's a squad, like your time will come and you'll be expected to step up and play. And I think Beaver-Jones did that yesterday. I think Perisset's done that over the past couple of matches. It will be interesting to see now Ashley Lawrence is back, what that configuration looks like. We have seen Perisset used on the left and Ashley Lawrence on the right in games in this season. And I do think New Charles's form has fallen off a bit over the past couple of weeks. So potentially that's something that we can see for the Arsenal game. But yeah, Perisset started the season impeccably, I thought. Then I was a bit confused about why exactly she lost her place to Lawrence, but she's come back in and performed. And maybe that was just a case of Hayes knowing that Lawrence was going away and she wanted to keep Perisset fresh. Maybe she felt like Lawrence was offering something different. Maybe it was just to mix it up and keep everyone on their toes. But I think that has always been, you know, what we've said is like Hayes is amazing skill, because I know, for example, with City, you say, oh, well, they've got a smaller squad because they didn't have Champions League. You need to keep people happy. Well, I think Chelsea kind of show that like, keeping people happy and keeping people motivated is a skill. There's not like a number that you can put on it, where if you've got 20 players, then they'll be happy across the season. And if you've got 26, then it's impossible. You know, it's about how you do that as a manager, how you push players to play at their best.
I also think with injuries, number of games, the situation that Chelsea have been in competitions, for example, basically securing their Champions League knockout place fairly early on, that gave the opportunity for players who'd been on the cusp, you can start this game, you can get 90 minutes. Obviously then you rest other players, but I do think Chelsea are quite good of almost kind of like front loading competitions to secure their status, and then with the number of games it's like everyone can feel like they played their part rather than persisting with almost like Serena Wiegmann does with England, like the same 11 just for the sake of consistency, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, also to an extent this season, Chelsea haven't really had a choice, you know.
Exactly.
The reason why Frank Kirby's starting as the nine and Aki Beaver-Jones is out wide and in the game against Everton is because Chelsea have three strikers who are seemingly unavailable through injury. Okay. Hayes sort of just said, oh, we've left Ramirez at home because she wasn't quite ready and we didn't want to like risk it, but who knows what that means.
It's also ridiculous having two of those being brand new players that you've... I mean, like, the odds on all of that happening, the Ramirez one, maybe not so much, because I don't think the serious... That doesn't seem like a serious injury anyway. But the odds on all of these happening at once is kind of ridiculous.
There is a striker curse on Chelsea football club.
The fact that, you know, they've got all of that, and I think that also shows... Actually, this is something I want to talk about because I was texting you about it yesterday. And yet again, we're not even talking about Kat Macario. I do think it's mad in the context of, and like part of it is Chelsea's budget, ambition, the way that they manage the market. And that means the way that they recruit, but also the way that they sometimes brutally, but very smartly let players go and are very clear with, your time has come, shuffle off to the little farm.
To Manchester United.
To Manchester
normally.
United, or wherever it is. You know, that Chelsea have been very good in the Hayes era of knowing when a player's life cycle is done at the club. But I do think it's crazy to me that the narrative and the conversation around Kat Macario has actually been really, really quiet. Because when you think about when she broke onto the scene, highly rated US international college player, decides to go to Lyon instead of the NWSL, has some big moments for Lyon as well, has that unfortunate injury, and that kind of sees her, the talk around her and the hype around her just disappear off a cliff, which is fine. She's injured. She's not playing. Chelsea sign her. We get her now. Like, I want to go on one of those like Google Trends graph to see like the amount of people that were Googling her. She arrives at Chelsea. We see a spike again in conversation around her. And then because obviously she's not ready for a long time, suddenly it goes completely quiet again. But when you see the context of the fact that Chelsea still got a really highly rated hype player, but yet because of her injuries and because of everything else going around the club, actually, we've kind of barely spoken about her. And yet she's hit the ground running very quickly since coming back. And you're like, oh my God, it's actually like, let's just take a step back for me at the moment and say, that is Kat Macario, who was one of the most highly rated, excited, you know, people were so raving about her when she was coming up in the US women's national team. And Chelsea have got her for the end of the season. That is massive. I feel like, I know it sounds stupid, but we should be talking about it more.
I think your reaction is kind of what a lot of Chelsea fans have had as well. You know, I think that definitely for me, there was this kind of forgetting sort of who Macario was, what she could be. And I think that was also due to sort of an uncertainty of when she'd be available. And as it is, it feels like she's done that thing where she suddenly popped up quite quickly. And obviously then the fact that she scored in both the games she's played in and scored almost as soon as she's come onto the pitch in both of them, I think has kind of reminded everyone of what she's able to do. For me, I think what's really exciting is how physically ready she looks. Mm. And, you know, before she scored against Everton, she was like already going in on players, like looking to win the ball. I think that's something that's really exciting because it's easy when players come back from injury to think maybe they're not ready for that kind of level of intensity. And then, yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, the goal is amazing for Kat, and her movement to kind of create the separation from Van Havermaet is really important. But I almost feel like it's kind of taken the sheen off the fact that Aggie Beaver-Jones basically does all the hard work. Mm. But it's really exciting, I think, also for those two. You know, like both Kat's goals have been assisted by Aggie. They're players who are kind of coming into a new version of Chelsea to a certain extent. We're not there yet, but like realistically, neither of those are going to be Emma Hayes's players in inverted commas, because obviously Aggie's kind of having her first senior season with the club and Kat's only playing for us for the first time in March. But yeah, I think especially with the issues with the strikers, being able to have someone like Macario available off the bench and potentially available to start hopefully sooner or rather than later is a massive, massive boost.
Quickly, before we move on, give me a brief summary of Brighton losing to Manchester United. It was the most one-sided tie of the whole FA Cup weekend. So I don't want to dwell on it too much. But you were there, so like,
there.
What went down? Because it looked like a pretty embarrassing day for Brighton.
Yeah, bumped into friend of the pod, Mark Parsons. That was nice.
He's everywhere we go.
He's
in our DMs.
You
he's in
cannot
our comments.
Move for that man at the moment. That was fun. And then yeah, the game itself was not thrilling to me. I thought Brighton were really, really poor, kind of in all phases of defense. They're doing a lot of playing out from the back at the moment, which I don't hate.
Trendy.
I don't hate as a concept, and I do think in some games it's helped them quite a lot and it's made them look good. But I did think in this game against United, they just looked so out of sorts. I thought Maria Torres-Dottir was really, really struggling on the ball, and United just attacked basically their fullbacks, and they had Emma Kullberg at left back, they had Paulina Bremer at right back. Obviously Poppy Pattinson's kind of been their consistent left back this season for them. She wasn't available, and they were just really struggling to kind of control the space. And I think also their midfield feels quite lightweight at the moment. They were playing Pinto, Zigliotti and Lasada, and I couldn't really figure out whose role was whose kind of exactly in that game. And yeah, I mean, also from corners and set pieces, just not picking up anyone. You know, the first goal comes from a Millie Turner header, but like, it's the second phase of play and Turner had already won the header from the first phase. Brighton had failed to clear, and then the ball comes back in, and again she managed to sort of rise highest to head it home. And it's not like Brighton are necessarily a short team. They do kind of have players in that defence when you look at Torres-Dottir, when you look at Bergsven. So I think that will be a frustration. The bright point for Brighton, I would say, is I do think when they brought on Madison Haley and kind of played her with Elizabeth Turland in this sort of like quite physical front two, they looked better. I do think Haley, like, I really, really like her as a player and I really want her to come good at Brighton. And so I think it'll be interesting to see whether she gets a start at any point soon. And for United, I thought it was exciting to see Lisa Naslund in a game that wasn't quite as important. It feels like she's been kind of thrown in at the deep end. Oh, Skinner goes on about having to wait until players are ready. She's kind of been thrown in at the deep end at different points and I think has struggled in certain games. But I thought physically against the Brighton midfield, she looked really good. She took a really good goal. And it just felt like she was offering United a bit more bite, especially like linking up on that right-hand side with Riviere and Garcia. And I thought Mallard looked sharp as well. I feel like we've not seen, I know she had an injury and then she seemed to disappear the way United players kind of do. But I thought she looked back to her best. So yeah, United I thought were good, but they were helped out by Brighton being pretty pathetic.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what the draw gods can try and deliver for the semi-finals. I think it's Tuesday morning. Obviously, we're not doing it. I know, write to the FA with your complaints, but there's nothing we can do. It's out of our hands. That's enough FA Cup chat. Let's talk Women's Gold Cup. All right, Women's Gold Cup, USA winning the inaugural edition, beating Brazil 1-0. This final was not a classic, all right? But I don't want to focus so much on USA's sort of winning this because it was a roller coaster of a ride and there was that defeat to Mexico, which a lot of fans were frustrated about. The setup, the lineup, it felt naive. I want to talk about what this tournament and what some of these performances show us about the Emma Hayes era that's on the horizon, because there's a couple of young players I want to talk about specifically, but we'll get onto them. But you know, there's lots of conversation around how much influence Emma Hayes had on this squad and who played in this tournament and how they played. Jesse, as someone who's like obviously following this story and everything that's going on closely, how much of an impact do you think she had, and how much of this feels like the soon to be Emma Hayes era at the USWNT, and how much of it is almost like this weird sort of interim before we get to that?
What I like about this situation is if you think that the US weren't very good and the way they set up wasn't very good, you can kind of say, oh, well, Emma's not here yet. But if you think when it goes well and it works out, you can say, oh, we're so excited for Emma Hayes. It's like she's like Schrodinger's manager at the moment. She's like there and she's not. I think realistically, knowing Hayes, not personally, but like having watched her career, there is no way in my mind that she wasn't involved in elements of this. Just because she's got such a short amount of time to get this team ready for the Olympics. Like, of course, you're going to want to see certain things in this kind of tournament. And I guess this was like a little bit of the tension for the USA, because I guess the result at the World Cup has given them some kind of internal conflict about where they stand in world football. And obviously, this was a home tournament with, you know, good teams, historic rivals, you know, thinking of a semi-final against Canada, final against Brazil. It's something you do want to win, but at the same time, you've got a new manager coming in who's probably trying to figure out how she wants to play. And we've kind of seen like different versions of that. Like last night was this kind of strange 4-4-2 with Rose Lavelle out wide, for example. So I think that has meant that there's kind of like, there's a lot of different things going into this at the moment in terms of being able to get the team ready for the Olympics. I do think the football has not been great.
It's not been a classic.
I think there's been some bright moments. I think Emily Fox had a really good tournament. She obviously got the assist for the goal.
What a cross, by the way. No, but genuinely from the area, it reminded me of Saar's cross in the Villa men Spurs game on Sunday for Madison's goal, I think the first goal. But to put in a cross that's that accurate and perfect from where she is on the pitch, like, oh, just a beautiful ball.
I will say, Brazil defence.
Useless.
Why are you letting Lindsay Horan just like waltz in front of you?
And leap
like that. Like, that's obviously the player you should be marking, right? But yeah, so I think, you know, she's someone who's been a real bright spark. Obviously, Jaden Shaw didn't start the final, but she's looked really, really good throughout this tournament. The player I'm really intrigued about is Alex Morgan, because obviously Morgan wasn't called up initially. Mia Fishel does her ACL. They call Morgan up. She starts all the knockout games. That obviously wasn't the plan going into this tournament. So I am so intrigued about what changed.
That brings me on to one of the key things I want to talk about, the Gold Cup.
Because wow, so in sync.
You've really just set me up perfectly there. Jaden Shaw, breakout tournament for her, gets the golden boot. Doesn't start in the final, much to a lot of fans' frustration. 19 years old, has been playing in the shadow of Morgan at the Wave. Arguably has, well, definitely has a much better tournament than her. Looks like this bright spark that sort of only just arrived. She came into the US Women's National Team setup at the back end of last year. She looks really, really, really good. And there's now such a big question mark about what kind of role Alex Morgan is going to play, because it, like, while we've seen other players age out, understandably, and like, I think Morgan had a bit of a Morganaissance at the Wave in Stoney's first year, and that got her back into the conversation when there had been question marks about her. She has a poor World Cup, and then everything comes back about those doubts. And we've seen her age mates move on with Heath and Press probably out of the picture for the foreseeable, even though they haven't like officially retired or anything. Obviously, Rapinoe's retired. Carly Lloyd went, you know, a while ago now. But I do think Morgan's in this really difficult position where she's clearly a very important leader, and like, they keep asking her to come out and face the music when things are going badly. And she's a great leader, and she's almost been like, you know, having read around Shaw and her growth, like, Morgan's been a key part of that because she's learned so much from her at the Wave. But there are people ready and waiting now, with Sophia Smith, who never really kind of got going in this tournament, but with Shaw now, like, there's plenty of options in that position. What kind of role is Alex Morgan going to play with Emma Hayes? Because she's in that place now where you get picked a bit like Ellen White, I guess, based on your credit in the bank and what you've done for your national side. But arguably, there are other better options. And Shaw, I think, only got 6 goals last season for the Wave. But like, she looks like she's going to be in brilliant form for this incoming season. So I'm really intrigued to what happens now.
The thing that confuses me about it is just that switch that we see around her going from not being picked at all to being picked and used all the time, because I kind of saw her not being in the squad not necessarily as like a full snub per se, because I do think, like, as I say, I think this tournament needed to be an opportunity to see different players. But then if that's your logic, then like you're saying, why are you playing Morgan? Because I do think she can have an important role to play in this team, especially when you've got kind of younger players coming through. Cynical version of me is like, Emma Hayes is at Chelsea with Kat Macario. Does she just think, I'm going to play Macario as the 9 at the Olympics, so I'll just put sort of Morgan there as a filler piece and try players around her? I do think, like, that's not a bad role for Morgan to play, but it still feels a bit weird to, like, what if Macario has a setback? What if she doesn't make the Olympics, you know? So I think it's just that, as you've kind of touched on, like, what exactly is Morgan's role? Because, you know, Ellen White, for example, was hugely important for England. And there's not a doubt in my mind that if she hadn't retired, she would have gone to the World Cup for England as well, and potentially even started at the World Cup. So I don't think there's anything wrong with sort of like backing and working with your veteran striker, especially as you're moulding a new team. But why was that the case that you didn't want to do that before the start of the tournament, but without Fischl, you're like, okay, I've got to start Alex Morgan in like every game?
Yeah, the way that she had to start was just bizarre, really. Another player I want to shout out, I know you're also a big fan, Jenna Nyswanger, who we talked about when we talked about the NWSL Championship final. Won Rookie of the Year, obviously prolific at university level as well. It's funny seeing a reply to a tweet I tweeted, I think around the group stages of the Gold Cup, around how she's been like, you know, such a revelation for Gotham and for the US. And someone replied saying, you know, this just shows how college football prepares you so well, which I think you go back and forth on, because I think sometimes, you know, people have proven now recently that you can bypass college.
Well, Jaden Shaw is exactly the great example. Trinity Rodman as well.
You can bypass college and go straight in. But there are obviously other players where that experience, you know, I think the jury's still out on whether the college system is good enough to really...
There's not one right pathway for a player,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And everyone is different. So I don't think it's as good as saying, oh, well, if they're like elite at college level, they're definitely going to be able to make that step up. I think a lot of players have shown that development is perfect. But I think, you know, for a lot of people in Europe, they would say that preparing yourself in European football is just as strong. But, you know, it is impressive how she's basically just gone from really elite at college level to dropping straight into the professional environment and excelling again. And she is a player that I'm just excited to see where she can go. Obviously, like, she's not as young as Shaw or Rodman in those levels because she's 23 and they're, you know, they bypass that. So she's got like a lot of game time at a decent level. But I still think, you know, there are players who didn't make that jump when they go into the NWSL. And I think she is someone I'm really excited to see more of.
Yeah, definitely. I think Corbin Albert is also obviously someone who has caught a lot of attention. And I think for me, that's like, that really feels like a bit of an Emma Hayes hand of like kind of plucking someone, not random per se. But, you know, I think she's someone that clearly it feels like Hayes is very keen on and has had a lot of opportunities with the US women's national team ever since Hayes was appointed. And I think she's definitely offered a sort of bit of fresh air to a midfield that I think justifiably was focused on at the World Cup as not really making sense. I do think what's interesting is it feels like there are quite a lot of players in and around that midfield. And obviously in the final, we see Lavelle kind of used out wide, I guess, as a result of that, because they played Coffey with Albert and then Horan obviously slightly ahead of them. So it will be interesting as well, because Fox has been inverting a lot into that space, which I think has worked well. And, you know, for example, in the Mexico game, that's kind of where the US's like best opportunity comes from. So I definitely think for me, this US team is like, there are green shoots because there are good players, but obviously there are good players because the US youth system is like probably the best in the world, realistically. Especially now, actually, I think because they've got these divergent pathways that you're talking about, I think that's great for different players, you know, to be able to bring through players at different times, because, you know, people are going to go on different journeys and peak at different moments. But in terms of playing as a team, I still think that feels like a very long way off for the US. Watching the final in particular, I did think they were quite poor for large portions of the game. And I'm fascinated to see how much impact and how quickly Hayes can have, because regardless of whether we think she's kind of in Kilgore's ear, she's obviously still not like on the ground at every game.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I think that's it for today. But we're going to be back on Thursday because we've got a massive game on Friday night at Stamford Bridge.
Yep.
Chelsea hosting Arsenal. So on Thursday's show, we're going to preview that. It's also the return of the end of a sale soon because obviously we've had the Gold Cup now. So that's exciting. We're going to talk a little bit about that.
I'm getting into the NWSL this year, guys.
So. Is that your thing?
That's going to be my thing because there's no, well, there's obviously the Olympics, but like there's no real big time devouring tournament football.
But then what are you going to do about time difference? So all
I'm
going to
watch
the
games the next morning.
Okay, that's fine. I'm up for that, but I just can't. I'm a real...
I'm going to approach it like a book group and okay. I'm going to focus on different teams each week and then watch them in the morning.
Oh, I quite like that. That's quite a nice way to break it down. Yeah, I just for me, I feel very old and staying up past like 11 o'clock is really tough for me. Like, I'm genuinely not even joking. So... pushing through to watch games live is tricky. So normally I end up catching up with extended highlights. But if we're going to make it like NWSL Homework Club, I'm here for it. And we'll do some 490, 1.5 speed discussion groups.
Join us, British Counterpress listeners.
Join us, British Counterpress and US Counterpress listeners. Come tell us what the big storylines we should be looking out for, because we want to hear from you what sort of tomfoolery there's going to be in the NWSL this season. Jesse, pleasure seeing in the jam room with you.
Let's go write some tunes.
Let's go write some amazing music. Thank you, Counterpress listeners. If you love Counterpressed, tell us / tell your friends / rate and review on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. On Spotify, give us 5 stars. On other platforms, drop a little comment in. Thanks for your love and support. Follow us on Twitter, follow us on our new Instagram, and follow us on TikTok. We will see you all on Thursday.